Da-da-da! Welcome, folks, to this week's edition of the Indie Week. John Federson here from the North Carolina Reading Service with our program, as all of them, designed for listeners who are blind or print impaired. And this week's edition is dated May the 14th of 2026. And here we go. And here we go from Durham County. Durham County budget proposal raises property taxes and but falls short of the Durham Public Schools ask. Dwindling revenue sources and increasing service needs put Durham County Manager Claudia Hager and her staff between a rock and hard place as budget season ramped up at Monday night's County Commissioners meeting. Hager said, Durham County's navigating a new and challenging environment. With limited funding options available, Hager is proposing a 2-cent property tax increase and a Durham Public School budget increase that's less than half of what the district asked for, saying the proposed budget continues a delicate balancing act between limited resources, resident economic stress, and nearly infinite needs. The total budget proposal comes in at $1.045 billion. It's a marginal 67%, less than 1% increase from the current year's budget, which eclipsed the billion-dollar mark for the first time in the county's history, due in part to a growing population of taxpayers. The county is experiencing significant stagnation in natural revenue growth. That's new revenue without a property tax increase. Starting the 26-7 budget process with less than $1 million in added revenue compared to the $68 million in new funding requests from various county departments. Hager's reads, nearly all these funding requests were ultimately not able to be supported. In an effort to close that remaining gap, departments made $6 million in cuts to focus on funding basic needs, and the proposed property tax increase would generate an additional $17.5 million in revenue. Uncertainties at every level of government make this year's budget negotiations more difficult to balance. Inflation and rising gas prices are driving up everyday costs, and the state legislature has not passed a budget in over 2 years, straining local government services that are partially funded by the state, none more than public education. Now, parenthetically, we're hearing stories that there is some Republican agreement on budget, although it's not an actual budget, but there's been some breakthroughs there. But this article doesn't reflect that. Education remains the county's biggest expenditure, which includes funding for Durham Public Schools, DPS, and Durham Technical Community College. During a school board meeting in March, DPS board set its budget at a massive $28.5 million increase compared to last year. The Durham Association of Educators, that district's majority member union, is pushing the school board and the county to invest in classroom equipment and a higher minimum wage, not to mention building improvements, among other things. County commissioners and staff have said the request is untenable due to the myriad of other budget demands. Hager still recommended a nearly $11 million increase in funding for DPS over the current year's budget, bringing the total county funding for public schools to $235 million. An additional $1.5 million was recommended for pre-K funding. Hager said, while we have made substantial progress with these funds, I'm aware of the remaining gaps within the district, but there are also limits to what the county can annually fund for DPS without either significantly limiting resources for other services or needing to increase the property tax rate every year. Public education relies on an increasing proportion of its funding from the county. For 6 straight years, the county has increased school funding by over $10 million, Advocates say the state legislature continues to underfund public schools, forcing the county to fill in the gaps for things like teacher wages and other programs. The DAE doesn't seem to be dropping its push for higher wages. Later this week, the group is holding a living wage town hall at North Star Church of the Arts to further voice their position to the county commissioners. The group posted on their social media, "In order to win funding from the county, we need to stand united and let the county commissioners know this step toward a living wage for DPS workers cannot wait another year. Without more financial support from the state and federal government, the county has limited options for bolstering its coffers." Hager said raising taxes this year could alleviate some of the revenue woes. Each 1 cent per $100 of assessed value would raise about $8.8 million. But residents are already feeling squeezed by property increases. Last year, the county lowered the property tax rate from 79 cents to 55 cents to mitigate a spike in tax bills that occurred following a countywide property revaluation. The County Tax Administration Office saw a higher-than-usual number of appeals of those newly assessed values this year, many from commercial properties, which had an adverse impact on the county's revenue. Hager said, "I would like to remind the board and residents that the property tax is the primary revenue source controlled by the board and the only significant way to raise additional revenue to address pressing needs. The state legislature could wrangle that control away from county governments across the state. The Republican-led State House recently proposed a constitutional amendment to limit the ability for local governments to raise property taxes, which would further hinder how counties generate revenue. In addition to investments in education and public safety, the recommended budget includes $500,000 to support a joint city-county homeless strategic plan and $250,000 for a violence reduction plan." Hager also said the county plans to make improvements in transportation by expanding travel options with programs like Central Bus Rapid Transit. The public will have the opportunity to raise its own 2 cents at a budget public hearing on May 26th. And then the county commissioners are scheduled to vote to approve the fiscal year budget on June the 8th. More budget. Wake librarians say chronic understaffing is hurting service and morale. WCPL, Wake County Public Library, workers and supporters rallied outside a county commission meeting Tuesday evening to protest what they say is chronic understaffing within the library system. Workers say recent reductions to a staff that was already stretched thin has hurt morale and caused services like family story times, job help appointments, and off-site events to be scaled back. Librarian and Wake Library Workers United member Zach Morgan told the group of 40 Wake County library workers, patrons, and volunteers gathered outside the Wake County Commons building in Raleigh, quote, "We've been struggling to keep the same level of service going over the past year. I think we've done a good job of that because we're total badasses when it comes to what we do, but I know it's wearing a lot of people out." Wake County Workers United, Wake Library Workers United, that's a chapter of the North Carolina Public Service Workers Union, UE Local 150, organized the rally. The union argues WCPL has not meaningfully expanded its staff in the last decade, even as the county's population has shot up by about 30%. To make worse, over the last couple of years, WCPL cut so-called temporary staff hours by 30% across the system. WCPL has about 600 employees across 23 libraries, a mix of temporary and permanent staff. The temporary staff, quote, "help cover operational gaps created by vacancies, employee leave, and permanent staff assignments to committees or special projects," unquote, according to a Wake County spokesperson. On Tuesday, library workers told Indy These staffers fill essential customer-facing roles. They may not be librarians in the official degree-holding sense, but many patrons don't know the difference. In a press release from the union ahead of the rally, Wake librarian Maura Dixon likened the inadequate staffing levels to breathing only through a straw. According to their press release, 215 WCPL employees signed a petition last fall calling attention to the staffing crisis. The union says library management refused to meet with them to discuss the petition and potential solutions. In response to questions from Indy, Wake County shared a statement from WCPL Director Tammy Badgett that reads, in part, quote, "Library leadership recognizes that some employees have expressed concerns about workload and staffing levels," unquote. Baggett wrote that the library is conducting staff surveys and focus groups to better understand employees' grievances. Morgan said that's a good start, but it doesn't address WCPL's immediate staffing needs. Quote, "The survey is something we've been asking for quite some time. We do think it's the right step in the right direction, but any sort of a data gathered will not be actionable for at least another year or two. We're asking for a stopgap measure for staffing this coming year." Baggett did not directly address the allegation that she and other management have refused to meet with the union. She granted that temporary staff hours were cut this year due to a lack of funding, but said the library system still managed to serve 11,000 additional program participants year over year, and average attendance per program increased significantly. Morgan said Baggett's statement proves the union's point. "We have new types of programs and new services being offered with the same level of staff, if not less staff, year after year. That's the breaking point that we're reaching here." During the rally, community supporters shared their deep appreciation for Wake's libraries and library workers. A Cary resident, Steve Bader, said, "I've raised my kids through the library. I brought them to the library all the time, from the time they were 1 year old. Library workers were working with them, reading them stories, even when they couldn't fully understand. What's happening now with the reduction in staff makes it harder and harder and harder for the workers to give that kind of service." A high school history teacher in Durham, Carlos Perez, said he relies on libraries for teaching and for parenting. "We're all under attack in various ways, whether it's the libraries or public schools," he said. "If we're going to push back, we've got to lock arms and push together." Tuesday's rally preceded a public hearing on the county budget with that full Wake County Board of Commissioners in attendance. During the hearing, several library workers spoke about the need for more staff. Nikki Curtis, an employee at Oberlin Regional Library in Raleigh, described how with fewer temp staff, the remaining permanent staff have to spend more time on desk duty and less time on programming. According to Curtis, Oberlin Regional reduced its weekly story times from 12 to 8 and now only offers one-on-one job and technology appointments 2 days a week, instead of 5. The workers didn't ask the county commissioners for a specific dollar amount, but they urged them to find more money in the county budget for Wake's libraries. That's a tall order right now. The commissioners are dealing with a revenue shortfall of about $30 million caused by a property tax loophole and an unusually high number of tax appeals. They're already planning to raise taxes to make up the lost revenue, and there is not much room in the budget for additional investments. The county commissioners will vote on this budget, this is Wake County now, June 1st. Residents can submit their feedback online or at the next public hearing. Chapel Hill Public Library at risk of losing county funding. In March 25, the Southern Branch Library in Carrboro finally opened its door to the public after years of planning and anticipation. Prior to the opening, only two libraries existed in Orange County, located in Hillsborough and Chapel Hill, with the county's budget allocating about $620,000 to the main Chapel Hill location. A year after the Carver opening, county officials say it's time to shift direction, and at a May 5th meeting proposed a budget that would eliminate its funding for the Chapel Hill Library over a two-year phase-out. The proposed budget does not sit well with everyone. Friends of the Chapel Hill Library, that's a nonprofit that fundraises for the library, has launched a local campaign to advocate for the county revenue, calling on residents to voice opposition, with advocates pointing out the proposal would cut 72% of the library's operating budget and could lead to reduced hours and services. Operating costs do not, however, include personnel costs. The funding at risk of being cut amounts to about 14.5% of the library's total budget, according to an FAQ page that the public library has created in response to the proposed cuts. Friends of the Chapel Hill Library president, Karen Curtin, said cuts could start with a reduction in hours and the removal of free library cards for those who live outside of the town. Quote, the operating costs are what are going to have the most immediate impact because that's what we put into collections, funding, part-time staff, and programs. Those are the things that really impact people. To offset the cost, the town of Chapel Hill could, according to the library website, raise property taxes and charge for using meeting rooms and printers to increase their revenue. The town could also reduce costs through laying off part-time staff, reducing weekend hours, or cutting its collections budget. The library currently receives $620,000 annually from the county, an allocation which would be halved beginning July 1st of this year. All funding from the county would end July 1st, 2027, and the county's current contribution makes up about 0.5% of its general fund expenditure, 0.5%. The town of Chapel Hill has primarily funded the library. The town provided about $3.5 million to the library last year, about 72% of the library's revenue. The county has historically given Chapel Hill money to cover Orange County residents' use of the Chapel Hill Library. A memo from the county manager reads, but now those residents have a county facility offering, quote, robust library services. The memo reads, that payment was conceived during a time when the county and the town were seeking interoperability. Since that time, the county has constructed the Southern Branch Library at the Drake Ford Building in Carrboro. Some Orange County and Chapel Hill residents have shared their concerns with the county. In an email to commissioners, Orange County resident Emma Tinch said the library is, quote, an essential resource for all county residents. Quote, I have used both Chapel Hill and Carrboro, and they are complementary to each other. One is not going to be able to fulfill the function of the other. Suggesting that the existence of the Carrboro Library means Orange County should no longer fund CHPL is a misunderstanding of how libraries work and the populations they serve. Resident Alec Higgins wrote the proposed cut would have substantial consequences for the area's primary and premier library. The Chapel Hill Public serves about 40% of the county's residents, offers far more extensive programming, a larger collection, and more accessible location than Southern Branch. To residents of Chapel Hill, and CHPL shares those perks with residents outside of our town. Why should Chapel Hill residents be asked to pay for our share of Orange County libraries and fully fund our own library because a new facility was built nearby? Commission Chair Jean Hamilton, who supports the proposal, said it is necessary, given the county's budget crunch. The county provides funding to both Orange County and Chapel Hill Carrboro City Schools, the Sheriff's Office, and Public Health, among other items. The money mostly comes from property taxes. Hamilton said, given where we are with cuts in federal revenue, not getting money from the state, the county is put in a very difficult position of trying to maintain services that we are mandated to give. Hamilton said she will look at everything to reduce the tax burden on residents, but ceasing payments to Chapel Hill's library would be a first step. In a statement to Indy, Vice Chair Amy Fowler said the proposed budget included a number of cuts to most county departments. However, Fowler said she plans to bring an amendment to the commission to restore that funding. Quote, I am personally a big fan of the Chapel Hill Public Library and see firsthand on a weekly basis how much of a community hub it serves. It also seems equitable to fund library services for all Orange County citizens. The amendment would need four commissioners to vote for it, which Fowler said she's not sure will happen, as the board members remain, quote, very focused on preventing a tax increase. With the cuts, Orange County residents who live outside of Chapel Hill could lose access to free library cards. Currently, Chapel Hill library cards cost $65 for anyone who lives outside of Orange County, including residents of Alamance, Caswell, Chatham, Durham, and Person counties. Curtin said the proposal cut left her quite stunned, considering the large number of Orange County residents who live in Chapel Hill. It's a problem, and it's a big part of our budget, Curtin said, and there are many people in the county in Chapel Hill, including those who are not residents of Chapel Hill, who are very unhappy about it. The Orange County Board of Commissioners will hold their budget public hearing and work session May the 12th, and it will vote on its budget on June the 16th. All right, one new article that just was printed today on their IndieWeek's website, Apex, fulfilled 97% of public records requests last year. Requests for the mayor's communications are the exception. Those who open the Mayor Jacques K. Gilbert app find the Apex town leader greeting them with a smile as shiny as the ceremonial shovel that hangs behind his desk. He says in the app's introductory video, I want to start out the saying transparency isn't just a word, it's actually a bridge that builds purpose and trust. The mayor promises real-time updates without all the unnecessary clutter and a direct channel for communicating with him. This personal app, launched in 2025, appears to be the only such effort by a North Carolina municipal official. In addition, the mayor runs Facebook and Instagram profiles that reach more followers, than those of Raleigh, Charlotte, and Greensboro mayors combined, even though Apex population is less than a 20th of those cities' total. Over the past month, his posts have ranged from a video of squirrels wrestling, to ordering the first milkshake at Apex's new cookout, to a sober analysis of the town's budget. Gilbert's knack for charismatic digital communications has helped raise his political profile since his election in 2019. According to a question and answer with The Line, he was recently appointed chair of the NC Metro Mayors Coalition, but the mayor's freewheeling approach to blending official business with personal platforms has created tension with staff and raised questions about his adherence to state public records law. Chapter 132 of the General Statutes requires local governments to make nearly all documents created as part of public business, even when they are produced on privately managed platforms, available, quote, as promptly as possible upon request. The town of Apex has generally been a model of compliance. Officials filled 299 of the 307 requests they received in 2025, when North Carolina Local asked for the same set of records from the state's 20 largest cities. Apex was the second fastest to respond, producing the requested emails in just over 1 hour. Gilbert's communications have been a notable exception. According to an April report by Apex Town Clerk Alan Coleman, the majority of the unfulfilled requests from 2025, two of which are from the Indy, remain open, quote, pending the mayor's response regarding communications outside town email. Dating back to October, the open requests deal with controversial issues where Gilbert has taken public stances. These include his advocacy for a bike trail on town-owned land near the Charleston Village neighborhood, questionable use of town purchasing cards, and support of a for-profit parking lot in a residential area. Gilbert's app, which sets its mission as bridging the gap between town government and residents, offers his perspectives about town business, listings of events such as town council meetings, and a contact form inviting users to connect with the mayor. Gilbert says these messages, quote, are automatically routed to my town email. However, the app's terms and conditions state that its activities, quote, remain private and separate from town business, noting, quote, communications generated through the app are routed through private email accounts and not delivered to Town of Apex servers. Regardless of how those messages are handled, experts in public records law say that Gilbert is still required to disclose relevant communications. Ashley Fox, a lawyer who helps operate the North Carolina Press Association's legal hotline, said, if the content of messages sent or received through this app is related to public business, they are public records, regardless of whether they are routed through private mail, email, or maintained on a private device. Ultimately, it's the content of each individual message that determines whether it is public record, not what the terms and conditions of the app may say. Reached for comment by the Indy, Gilbert said he takes compliance with records law seriously. He explained he personally reviews all messages received through the app and handles any town-related communication according to legal requirements. Quote, I have been actively working to review and compile any responsive materials. Given that this includes communications that may exist outside of standard Town of Apex email systems, it requires a thorough and careful review to ensure completeness and accuracy. Other Apex officials, including Town Clerk Coleman and Public Records Coordinator Paris, have no access to privately run apps or social media accounts. The town must rely on individual elected officials or staff members to comply with the law. Pete McMichael, director of the NC Open Government Coalition, previously told the Assembly that a lack of oversight for official business on private channels is an issue across the state, saying, it's hard to believe you're getting everything if you know for a fact they're using their personal devices to communicate. There need to be some guidelines and maybe some real teeth in the public records law to try to encourage government officials to stop using private devices. Gilbert also claimed he had not been made aware of the unfulfilled request until the end of February. However, an email from Paris, dated in January, noted that the town was coordinating with the mayor to gather records from his personal communications. Coleman confirmed Gilbert had received a message in February. Coleman did not respond when asked about any prior communication between the mayor and clerk's office. Apex resident Matt Barnes, who filed three of the requests for Gilbert's records, has been frustrated by the lack of response. Even though the mayor has boasted about driving engagement on town government business through his social platforms and apps, Barnes said Gilbert, quote, operates in this gray space of official private, making it next to impossible to get a clear picture about those communications. Gilbert said, I remain committed to transparency and fulfilling these requests in accordance with state law, and I will continue coordinating with town staff to bring them to closure as soon as that review is complete. Gilbert is not the only Apex leader who communicates regularly outside of town channels. Councilmember Terry Mahaffey maintains an active Substack and social media presence, and he recently launched the Peak News Network as a, quote, local news aggregator. None of the unresolved 2025 requests mention Mahaffey's communication. One does mention Councilmember Edward Gray. Mahaffey responded, I put significant time into making public information easier for residents to find and understand. I do that work myself using my own technical skills and non-town resources. I also recognize that public officials have public records obligations, and I take those obligations seriously. APEX has been considering clearer communication policy for elected officials. Coleman provided the mayor and town council with a memo on press releases and social media best practice consideration on April 20th, and officials discussed potential policies at a work session in April. The memo read, the town may define processes, clarify use of official resources, ensure compliance with public records and open meetings laws, and set expectations for distinguishing personal views from official statements. Town officials are expected to revisit their social media policy this June. All right, a little transition music, because I think we're leaving official, real governmental articles and moving into some cultural and sort of mixed media articles, if you will. Although this first one by Christine Zhu and Laura Leslie from NC Newsline talks about North Carolina musicians and concert venues are joining lawmakers in a push to ban reseller bots and ticket fraud. That sounds pretty legal. Heather Lagarde owns the Haw River Ballroom, a venue with a capacity of 750 in Saxapple Hall, North Carolina. 15 years ago, Gillian Welsh and Dave Rawlings were the first band to ever perform at Haw River Ballroom, and the group came back recently on tour. They were doing it, Lagarde told reporters. They were doing it in 6,000-person theaters across the nation, but they chose North Carolina. They chose Little Saxapahaw to do a special two-night run, which is incredible. It's life-saving for little venues like ours, and we love them dearly, and everyone wants to get into that show. Both nights of the show sold out in 4 minutes, leaving upset would-be concertgoers calling the ballroom. Lagarde estimates that reseller bots snatched up at least 100 tickets from each night. During the show, people lined up outside but couldn't get in without a valid ticket, but there were still empty spots inside she thinks were purchased by bots. Quote, we had really reduced bar sales, which hits your venues very hard because you don't have your full capacity. The bands had really reduced merch sales, which they rely on so much for their bottom line. Lagarde is one of the venue owners and musicians joining lawmakers to support legislation that would impose tougher penalties for fraudulent concert ticket sales in North Carolina and limit the number that can be bought by reseller bots. Senate Bill 489, titled Real Tickets, Real Fans Act, would implement more regulations for second- and third-party sellers, targeting price gouging and fraudulent sales of concert tickets. Under the legislation, resellers would need to clearly identify themselves as resellers, not the box office, official artists, or venue partner. The bill would also ban impersonators fooling fans into thinking they're buying directly from the source. Resellers would need to provide an active link directly to the primary seller, giving fans a chance to view the original listing. Additionally, the measure would ban the sale of speculative tickets, which aren't in the possession of a retailer at the time of listing, sale, or advertisement. The bill would also ban software scalpers from using bots to purchase tickets before real fans can even load the page, according to the primary sponsor, Senator Jay Chaudhuri, Democrat of Wake. Artists and musicians play a key role in driving tourism in North Carolina, Chaudhuri said. The measure would help preserve that industry. Quote, those economic contributions deserve the same marketplace protection We extend to every other industry so our constituents and fans don't need a fraud detection course to buy a concert ticket. When Jason Isbell came, Lagarde said he and the venue agreed to sell the tickets for $25, but resellers listed them on fake sites for $700, according to Lagarde. A woman surprised her husband with a ticket as an anniversary gift to see his favorite artist, said Lagarde. Upon arriving, she learned the ticket was fake. Quote, she's sobbing outside the door. She's hysterical. This is her gift of the year to her husband, and it's a fake ticket. In cases like these, venue owners can relay the story to the artist, and in some instances, the artist still allows them in, but neither the venue nor the artist ever sees any of the money paid for that ticket. Lagarde said, we cannot sustain that when it's 100 fake tickets. The artist can't sustain it. We can't work as a business and artists that way. Lagarde said fans who buy these overpriced or fake tickets often blame the venue or the artist, but she said fraudulent sellers set up sites that look like they belong to the venue. She explained, we've had websites say they're Haw River Ballroom that are using pictures from the Sydney Opera House, and people buy tickets there. You know they're using seating charts. We don't have seats. Every time they're very angry with us. Why was it $700 when it's still on sale for $25? And why is this fake? And where's my front row seat? Where's my VIP treatment? The bill has bipartisan support in the state Senate with both Democratic and Republican sponsors. But Sawyer said Wednesday the proposal also has plenty of powerful detractors. Sawyer said, I thought, well, this is going to be a simple bill. It's a no-brainer. Protect people, right? Well, it's not. What we've learned is that it's fraught with special interest and folks who want this bill to fail. Asked for more detail, Chaudhry said they've had pushback from secondary reseller sites who argue it restricts a fan's ability to resell their own ticket. Chaudhry said, nothing in this bill actually restricts that from happening, but what we're trying to do is crack down on very predatory practices that are taking place. NC Newsline contacted StubHub and SeatGeek, two of the largest ticket resale firms. Neither immediately responded to our request for comments on the proposed legislation. More real music. Good Moon Festival returns in October with Tyler Childers and MJ Lenderman. The festival run by Psychic Hotline will take place in October, October 8th through 10th, diverging from its previous ballpark format with shows at DPAC and small venues throughout downtown Durham. So why am I reading this now? Because tickets are going on sale, folks. After a year's hiatus, that Hotline's Good Moon will rise above downtown Durham once again. The weekend of October 8th through 10th with two headlining performances by Sylvan Esso at the Durham Performing Arts Center. Country music star Tyler Childers will also take the main stage at DPAC alongside special performances each night from neo-soul and jazz singer Michelle Nguyen-Cello, poet Aja Monet, and Mexican singer-songwriter Silvana Estrada. Other performances will take place throughout downtown Durham at the Pinhook, Bay 7 at American Tobacco Campus, and the newly opened Boom Club. The small club's format marks a shift from the event's previous freewheeling ballpark iterations in 2022 at the historic Durham Athletic Park, where it was billed as the greatest show on dirt, and in 2024 at the Durham Bulls Athletic Park. This year's lineup includes a range of artists across genres, including Lee Nalchi, Tash LC, Annie and the Caldwells, Cirque du Jour, Bass, Babe Heaven and Hex Files, and more. A probable special interest to locals is Saturday, October 10th, daytime event, a free concert at the Amphitheater at American Tobacco Campus featuring North Carolina's MJ Lenderman and Wook County Speedway, as well as a screening of guitarist William Tyler's music film, Time Indefinite. Sylvan Esso, which is the electronic music duo of Amelia Meath and Nick Sanborn, has been an integral part of Durham's music culture since the band's 2013 debut. Their first foray into anchoring a major local music event came in 2022 when the pair kicked off a three-night run at DAP, which drew a crowd of 12,000. The highs from that successful concert series segued directly into the debut of Good Moon Festival the following year at Durham Bulls Athletic Park. Though Meath told Indian 24, quote, "We've been reaching towards doing something like this for basically the entire time we've been a band." In the intervening time between festivals, Psychic Hotline has stayed engaged with their fans, local and abroad. Last summer, the label opened up its Mailroom retail space on Holland Street for pop-up shows and other collaborations. Psychic Hotline has also recruited international touring artists from their label to the Bull City, like Reina Tropical, the Mexican-born pop singer who performed at the last Good Moon and at Motor Call months later, and Japanese folk singer Ichiko Aoba, who made her Durham debut earlier this month at Carolina Theater, highlighting the label's diverse sonic palette. And finally, VIP tickets for Good Moon go on sale this Friday. General admission single-night tickets will be available on May the 22nd. The next article about an acclaimed novel, Heart the Lover by Lily King, commemorates three chums who bonded as students in Chapel Hill. With two of them departed, their friends recall an uncommon alliance that ended too soon. This article by John Drescher came out in May the 8th. Three college guys used to hang out at a house a few blocks from the campus of UNC Chapel Hill. Two of them lived there. The third was a close friend who lived at his fraternity, but spent most of his time at the rented house on North Street. The three, all English majors from other states, were smart and well-read. Individually, none would have been considered charismatic, but together, they were witty, free-flowing, and magnetic. Other students dropped by the house to enjoy the banter and intellectual stimulation. They were juniors and seniors, 20 or 21 years old, and they talked about the kind of silly things that college students talk about when they have time on their hands. But the three guys, JB, Jeff, and Kevin, also were interested in big ideas. They parried verbally as they talked about their professors, what they'd read recently, and what was in the news. The writer, Lily King, another English major from out of state, was drawn to them when they were all Carolina students in the mid-1980s. She wrote in Vogue magazine in 2020, "Our university was big, but these three guys had created a tiny, cozy world within it. The rest of the fall and winter, we played hearts and argued about Reagan's re-election. We talked in Irish accents and quoted James Joyce. With the three of them, I was always giddy from the banter." King wrote about the love triangle between her, J.B., and Jeff. She first dated J.B., who she met in the 17th century literature class, but fell in love with Jeff. She wrote about the three men again last year in her well-regarded novel, Heart the Lover. The New York Times and the Washington Post reviewed it warmly. Time magazine ranked it first in its list of the 10 best books of the year. Times' Lucy Feldman said, "What begins as a hormone-fueled story of a campus love triangle, punctuated by bag sex and the heady banter of English majors, reveals itself to hold far greater weight." Neither the real-life story nor the novel has a happy ending. Kevin Wolfe died of lymphoma in 2001 at the age of 38. Jeff Darcy died of lung cancer in 2019 at 56. J.B. Howard tended to both of them in their last days. There's a disclosure here. The author writes, "Howard has been a good friend since college, and I knew Wolfe and Darcy through him. I never met King at UNC Chapel Hill." The novel has created a buzz among their old college friends, now in their 60s, about what is fiction and what's not. But what's unquestionably real is the unusual male friendship that King portrays in Heart the Lover. Their friend Jeb Saunders, a state government lawyer who lives in Chapel Hill, says it's three guys who loved each other. But for Kevin and Jeff dying, they would have remained lifelong friends. What a gift that was to have that friendship at such a young age. They left an imprint on King even decades after she first hung out with him. She told me, I don't know that I see that quality of male friendship very often. I don't know how much in everyday life men really lean on each other and care for each other. The first time Howard met Wolf, when they were high school seniors, he detested him. They were invited to Chapel Hill for a weekend in late February as finalists for a prestigious Moorhead Scholarship. Howard, from Baltimore, thought Wolf, from New Jersey, was an insufferably arrogant Northeasterner. Wolf walked around the leafy old campus all weekend with his nose up in the air, Howard told me. 6 months later, they both were Moorhead Scholars, living in Old East Dorm, just a few steps from the old well, the best-known landmark at the university. This time, they hit it off. Howard later wrote to friends that Wolf turned out to be the most good-hearted, caring, and interesting friend anyone could ever have. Darcy, a horse race fan from Kentucky and a passionate reader, also lived in the dorm. The three discovered they had a lot in common. They stayed up most of an October night talking, which was the beginning of a conversation that lasted 4 years. Their friends appreciated their intellects and passion for exploring ideas. Tim Sullivan, who became the CEO of Ancestry.com and now lives in Chapel Hill, says they were really impressive. They were the reminder to me of why we were here at the university. They so clearly admired each other as friends and respected each other. Wolf, the most extroverted of the three, could be zany. He called himself the Wolf Man and poked fun at himself by mock bragging about his dating skills. His friends say, chuckling, the character in the novel based on Wolf, his name is Ivan, fits him perfectly. In the novel, Ivan Kevin returns to their unnamed college town after visiting Ireland in the summer. The female narrator writes, then he tells us about the landlord's daughter, the ferryman's sister, and a pretty French girl on the flight home who told him in a sexy accent if they didn't hold hands during takeoff, the plane would crash. But once they were safely in the air, she let go and refused to speak to him for the rest of the flight. He's amused that everything he says delights us. Wolf taught himself Mandarin Chinese and was fluent. He later moved to Hong Kong and pursued beautiful Asian women, which Howard said was as ardent and quixotic as it was hilarious. Carolyn Griffin Hall, who frequented the North Street House in college and now is a community worker volunteer in Nashville, Tennessee, said, I adored Kevin. He was so funny. He was like a little quirky gnome. He was delightful and super smart. While Wolf was exuberant, Darcy had an endearing sense of humor about his foibles and predicaments. His 6-page handwritten letter on a yellow legal pad, as usual, to a former professor in 1995 was classic Darcy. He described reading Dylan Thomas' nostalgic poem, Fern Hill, to his dying father, as he lived his last days wheelchair-bound at his Kentucky farmhouse. Also present were Darcy's brother and stepmother. Jeff Darcy began bravely but was overcome with emotion as he sought to meet the moment with the perfect farewell. He struggled to finish, but did. Oh, as I was young and easy in the mercy of his means, time held me green and dying, though I sang in my chains like the sea. He thought his family was deeply touched until he realized they were actually trying not to laugh. He wrote, everyone was grateful and relieved when I started laughing also. Howard was the quietest of the three. He was an English and classics major, studying the major Greek and Latin authors. Also played backup goalie on the UNC Chapel Hill's men's lacrosse team that won a national championship. Howard stood out on a team of ruffians. Saunders, a lacrosse teammate, grew his hair long in an effort to fit in. Howard didn't change his fumbling, over-caffeinated, coffee-drinking persona, nor his daily uniform of button-down Oxford cloth shirts and khakis. Though quirky, he had a measured, mature beyond his years sense of who he was. His teammates respected him for it, and many thought he was the most interesting guy on the team. Louise Gilbert Freeman, an artist and former college English professor who lives in Virginia, was friends with Darcy at prep school and with all three in Chapel Hill. She and her college friends called them the Triumvirate. Quote, they were intellectual compatriots, but also bonded in the way typical of male college friends. Lots of jocular ribbing, a shared private lexicon, she wrote. I was flattered to be included somewhere in that charmed circle, even as a ripple on the outer rim. I cared so much about what they thought of me. They stayed close after college. All three went to law school, Wolf and Darcy at University of Michigan and Howard at the University of Virginia. Wolf worked for an international law firm in Hong Kong, returned to the U.S., and never married. Darcy was involved with King on and off for a decade, but they ultimately split and established a long friendship. He stayed single. Howard married, had three sons, one named after Darcy, and divorced. The three men worked their schedules to see each other at least a half a dozen times a year. They got together in New York City at the beach, at weddings, on a cycling trip to Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Howard told me recently there was always something to look forward to. We all found each other interesting in some way. It's a unique friendship when you can create this world you're happy in with two other friends. He added, I liked being around two guys who were really, really smart and smarter than I was. We pushed each other in that way. It was truly a three-way friendship, he said. There was never a time when one was excluded by the others. Only death did that. Wolf got cancer in the late 90s. Howard and Darcy stayed close to him in his last year, researching his illness, arranging visits with his old friends, urging him on. On a train ride to New York to see Wolf, Darcy said to Howard, Do you realize how hard this is going to be when he dies? Howard said, Kevin fought really, really hard. Wolf endured a long period of chemo and radiation, hope and despair, and died in New Jersey in 2001 with Darcy and Howard at his side. Darcy and Howard's friendship, already strong, was cemented in their late 30s by Wolf's death for more than a decade. The two worked for the Maryland Attorney General. They saw each other regularly, Darcy becoming Uncle Jeff to Howard's three sons. Years before, when they were young, Darcy's romance with King had strained their friendship. King and Howard broke up at the end of Howard's senior year in 85, long before the internet and cell phones. When Howard returned to the U.S. from a summer trip to Europe, he learned his close friend and former girlfriend, who were still students, were dating. He was angry, not because he had hoped to rekindle his relationship with King, he told me, but because he thought Darcy had broken an Ernest Hemingway-esque code of masculine friendship. A man didn't date his close friend's former girlfriend, especially right after the breakup. King knew all this. She and Darcy kept that relationship entirely separate from his friendship with Howard. If Howard was in town and the guys went to a party, she couldn't go. If Darcy called Howard, King was not in the room. In the Vogue interview and in the novel, she describes their predicament in similar language. Darcy would lose his friendship with Howard if he chose King. King would lose Darcy if he chose Howard. It might have appeared that way at the time, but at the end, Howard and Darcy and Wolf remained close. Darcy's romance with King created a real strain on friendship with Jeff. But there was no force in the universe that was going to break their friendship with each other and with Kevin. Darcy, a longtime smoker, was diagnosed with cancer in late 2016, Howard accompanying him on doctor's visits. When he was hospitalized for the final time in Baltimore, Howard slept for several weeks on a fold-out chair in the room and spoke throughout the day with Darcy's doctors and nurses about his treatment. He also urged King, who lives in Maine, to visit, and quickly. When she arrived, she joined a raucous party in the hospital room, an NCAA tournament basketball game blaring from the TV amidst cheering and shouting. Darcy was in bed, hooked up to oxygen, his chest exposed, but joyous to be surrounded by the people he loved most. Darcy was witty, as usual. "You should do stand-up comedy," someone said. "Yeah," he responded, according to one of his friends. "Jeff Darcy, one night only." Everyone in that room during Darcy's last week felt a kind of mystic power. Freeman, his friend from prep school, said Darcy allowed his friends to see him raw and exposed, stripping them of everything superficial or extraneous. The parade of people finally dissipated one night. King writes movingly in the Vogue article about being alone with Howard and Darcy in his last hours, joined by Wolfe's spirit. She wrote, "His evil grin and cackling laugh, he came back then and sat in the room with us. I could hear him shuffling the cards." King's hospital visit marked the first time she'd seen Howard in decades. He was kind, warm, and grateful for her presence, even though I'd almost ruined their friendship decades ago. She'd never considered her romance with Darcy from Howard's point of view. What if her best friend had started dating Darcy as soon as she left town? Would she have forgiven her? Would King have slept in her hospital room night after night? King told me being with Darcy and the others at the end was heartbreaking and excruciatingly beautiful at all the same time. She felt honored and privileged to be included. As a novelist, King said, you have to let the characters do what they're going to do. But she wanted to capture Darcy's essence as well as his friendship with Howard, a kind of male friendship she had never seen before. That friendship is the big story in her book, she's often told, and she agrees. As Darcy was dying, Howard created a Facebook page, Darce World, for friends and family to honor and reminisce about him. After he died, Howard posted about their friendship with Wolfe, not wanting their compatriot to be forgotten. Losing him 18 years ago was a searing, life-changing experience for Jeff and me, he wrote. Howard lost contact with Wolfe's family. But when he beckoned them in that spring of 2019, Wolfe's siblings and mother traveled to the Baltimore hospital to visit Darcy one last time. Howard thought he was holding it all together at the hospital, but when he saw the Wolfe family, the floodgates opened. Their presence was a reminder of the pain and joy of a friendship that started long ago on an October night in an old dorm, three freshmen excited about finding their way forward in a new world full of promise. Kevin and Jeff are together now, he wrote. I can't wait to see them again. Heart of the Lover, a book by Lily King, reported on by John Drescher in Indie Week. And John Feddersen will be back with you next week for my next edition of The Independent. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Goodbye, everybody.